I'm Bob Franklin. The program is Like It Is. My guest today is Victor Lukacsin, and he is the author of the book Built from the Fire, the epic story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street. Thanks for joining me, Victor.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Franklin.
Absolutely. We're going to paint a picture of early 1900 America. And then we're going to come forward. And I want to share with our audience this particular picture, and then Victor will chime in. In 1919, Black writer and civil rights activist James Weldon Johnson dubbed this period during the summer of 1919 in America as Red Summer. Similarities of this horrible story exist today, as you will hear shortly. During the summer of 1919 in Omaha, Nebraska, a Negro man, Will Brown, was lynched. With his hands tied behind his back, a white mob laid him down, his body already riddled with bullets, on the city's downtown railroad tracks, doused him and burned his body. A crowd of white onlookers shouted and cheered as they witnessed Brown's tragic public death. Brown's scorched body was then dragged through the streets as further humiliation of a Negro man accused of assaulting a white woman. That's a picture that occurred in 1919, Omaha, Nebraska. 2 years later, tragedy struck also in Oklahoma. And so, Victor, I'd like for you to help to continue painting this picture of early Oklahoma in the 1900s, if you would.
Sure, I definitely can do that, Dr. Franklin. Oklahoma is a unique case because it is not quite in the South and not quite out of it. In the early 1900s, in fact, it was sort of being painted as a Black utopia. A lot of folks, Black folks who were living in the Jim Crow South, decided to travel west to Oklahoma. It was being proclaimed as the Eden of the West, for example, a place where Black people could expect to be equal with whites. And in some ways, it's sort of a grand tragedy, an ironic tragedy, what happened in this place, because, you know, as we'll discuss soon, it ended up being a place of even more intense racial violence than in the Deep South. But originally, Oklahoma was this place where Black people thought they would be able to get land, jobs, opportunity. In my book, Built from the Fire, I actually follow one specific family, the Goodwins, who lived in rural Mississippi, Water Valley, in the early 1900s, and decided that they wanted to journey west in 1914. In a place like Water Valley, if a Black man was walking down the sidewalk and a white man came into his line of view, he was expected to scurry into the gutter. And that was something that J.H. Gill and the family patriarch sort of couldn't countenance. He wasn't going to put up with that anymore. So this family came to Oklahoma, and they decided to settle in Tulsa, and specifically in the neighborhood of Greenwood. Greenwood actually predates the state of Oklahoma. Oklahoma became a state in 1907. The first business in Greenwood opened in 1905. And it was a community that was really benefiting from this oil boom that was unfolding in Oklahoma, and specifically in Tulsa. Tulsa was known as the oil capital of the world. And folks in Greenwood were able to benefit from that. They were able to start businesses for themselves, grocery stores, movie theaters, hotels, all sort of benefiting from this sort of gold rush almost that was going on in Tulsa and Oklahoma at the time. And Greenwood quickly became, you know, one of the most prominent Black communities in the Southwest. And a big reason for it was the fact that families like the Goodwins were coming. These families who were middle class, educators seeking education for their children, and seeking to get a better life in the Jim Crow South, all sort of pouring into Oklahoma and pouring into Greenwood. And that's really sort of one of the explanations for why this place really became a Black Mecca in some sense.
Well, and you also talk about, and I want to just expand upon the fact that you just made a Black Mecca. Blacks were very prominent there. They were well-educated. They had a high standard of living, in some instances, a higher standard of living than whites, correct?
That's true. There was definitely a class of Black entrepreneurs in Greenwood who were, as you say, doing Even better than white folks in some cases. I have a chapter in my book that kind of walks through some of these really successful entrepreneurial stories, and it's actually called "And Sometimes Better Besides." That was a poem that was published in the Black newspaper in Greenwood, sort of illustrating the fact that Black folks could do anything just as well as white people. Among those people that were there was J.H. Goodwin, like I said, who owned a grocery store and then a very successful funeral home in Greenwood, along with a man named S.M. Jackson. They had some of the finest funeral cars in the Southwest. You also had folks like J.B. Stratford, who owned the hotel, the Stratford Hotel, which is one of the biggest Black-owned hotels in the United States in the early 1900s, and got covered in outlets such as the Chicago Defender. It was that prominent. One of my favorite stories of the early Greenwood entrepreneurs was a woman named Lula Williams. Lula was a teacher in rural Oklahoma, circa, let's say, 1910 or so. And then she decided to open a confectionery right there on Greenwood Avenue in the heart of the Black Business District. Her son has a really great quote saying that it was the only place on the block you could get a drink besides bootleg whiskey, which I love. And Lula, she wasn't only satisfied with having this confectionery. She and her husband John also ended up opening a movie theater, the Dreamland Theater. Some folks might be familiar with the Dreamland if you watch the HBO show Watchmen that was on that sort of depicted the Tulsa Race Massacre a few years ago. The Dreamland was very prominent on that television show. But the Dreamland itself was, it was the most prominent Black-owned movie theater in the state. Lula herself ended up owning three movie theaters before the race massacre, and she was the only Black woman in the United States who owned three movie theaters. And so there really was this class of really successful, savvy entrepreneurs who populated Greenwood, and have really sort of become in our day today sort of these really important figures showing that Black folks were doing a lot and making a lot of moves, before the Civil Rights Movement. And we were really finding a lot of entrepreneurial success that was, to your point, sort of dismantled during that era of racial violence depicted by the Red Summer and the Tulsa Race Massacre.
And I want to stay in the community, the Greenwood community, a little longer because Blacks were actually circulating, making sure that their money stayed within their community. They were really not exporting their dollars to other communities. Talk a little bit about the dollar that entered Greenwood, how it just kind of turned over multiple times in the Greenwood community, helping other businesses and other Blacks in the Greenwood community.
Oh yeah, I'd love to talk about that. I actually have a piece coming out in the New York Times this month that kind of explores the Greenwood economy in that era and how it really was a model for other communities. One of the most fascinating things I found in my research actually was that so W.E.B. Du Bois, obviously a very prominent figure in this era, and we all know him sort of as a intellectual and sociologist, but he was an economist. He studied economics in Berlin during his education. And he was a huge advocate of group economics in Black communities. Like, how can we keep our money circulating among ourselves? If we're going to be put under the boot of Jim Crow, how can we sort of manipulate the system so that we benefit? That was a big mentality of Du Bois. And so in early 1921, Du Bois was on a speaking tour around the South promoting one of his books, and he came to Tulsa. I came to Greenwood. And I was able to access his travel diaries from that trip. And to kind of go back to Lula and her dreamland, she had this really prominent, successful theater. But right across the street, there was a white-owned theater on Greenwood Avenue called the Dixie. These are both two different theaters. They both were playing the most prominent films of the day. They both would book Black performers to come. But when Du Bois came, he found that everybody in Greenwood was going to the Dreamland, the Black-owned theater, and nobody was going to Dixie. Nobody was having it. And so Du Bois comments on the fact that that was the greatest effort he had ever seen anywhere in the South of Black people using their dollar to support their community. So Greenwood really was a model for keeping that dollar circulating. And so in one way, it was, a product of the times. Black people were often being excluded from white spaces, so the dollar had a tendency to stay there, but there was also an intentionality behind that. On Greenwood Avenue, customers had a choice between the Black-owned Dreamland, the white-owned Dixie, and they chose the Black-owned Dreamland more often than not. And so this piece I've just written for the New York Times kind of explores Du Bois's vision about group economics, and how Greenwood in particular was a place that really exemplified that.
Well, let's get into some specific questions, and then we're going to be darting back and forth as the conversation proceeds. Tulsa has gotten some attention in the last few years. As you mentioned earlier, the Watchmen television series was set there. A former President Trump made a campaign appearance during Juneteenth weekend in 2020. And 2021 marked the 100th anniversary of the massacre that took place there. Question to you, why did you want to write a book that focused so much on this part of the country, and why is it relevant now today?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting for me because the sort of this project evolved a lot, I think, as I wrote it. You know, the real reason I started on the book was to talk a little bit more and let people, a younger generation, understand that Black people sort of have a story in this country that goes beyond just the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. I'm 33 years old, and I'm from Montgomery, Alabama. And so when I was growing up, the Civil Rights Movement was, you know, obviously something that we learned so much about in my hometown. And I was having lunch with one of my high school friends, let's say 5 or 6 years ago, and we were talking about how we weren't really seeing any depictions of Black folks in history besides Civil War being brutalized as slaves, or the Civil Rights Movement, you know, fighting for freedom and justice, but also seeing us being attacked by dogs, sick with hoses, and all that kind of stuff. And so I asked my friend, who I think we were about 27 at the time, had he ever heard of Black Wall Street? My friend had never heard about this place, Greenwood. And so I just thought it made sense to write a story, a narrative that will really capture a Black community thriving on its own, you know? And so for me, the story of Greenwood is about much more than the race massacre. And my entry point to this was really about the success, the solidarity, the community. And so that was sort of how I got into the story. But, you know, little did I know when I began working on this in 2018 that, you know, we would have a summer of racial reckoning in 2020 that was in some ways similar to the Red Summer of 1919 that we discussed. You know, I couldn't have known in 2018 when I started on the book that we would have this conservative backlash to, you know, letting people read the books they want to read. Access to the vote, all the issues that we're dealing with that in many ways mirror what was going on in Oklahoma when Oklahoma sort of embraced Jim Crow and racist policies before the race massacre. And so, to be honest with you, again, maybe this is because of my age, but when I was younger, I had a big idea of America being sort of a place of linear progress. I was 18 years old when Barack Obama was elected president, and that had a huge impact on me. But I think between doing my research on the past and also studying our current issues, I've sort of come around to the idea that America maybe is more cyclical in the way its history operates. And maybe we're sort of destined or doomed, however you want to perceive it, to sort of retrace these same issues again and again. And so in that sense, I think understanding what was going on in Tulsa, in Greenwood, before the race massacre helps people to be a little bit more vigilant about trying to stamp out our worst tendencies as a country, our darkest inclinations, so we don't allow things to sort of spiral out of control the way they did in 1921. And so, you know, the book really is trying to balance both that story about solidarity and community in Greenwood with the reality that, you know, they've been undermined at every step by racist policies, and in the case of 1921, by racial violence.
I'm wondering now about backlash. You mentioned book banning and so forth. In terms of your research and the book, have you or do you believe that you'll get negative backlash? As an example, I did research on the Elaine, Arkansas race riot that occurred in Elaine, Arkansas in 1919. And many of the community individuals living there thought that by doing, unearthing that type of research was just dredging up bad memories. It was a long time ago. Why do we want to revisit that today? Backlash, are you concerned, or do you think bringing that part of the history regarding Tulsa to the forefront is healthy and helps the community heal?
Well, I certainly think it's healthy. Does everyone agree? I don't know. I don't think so. Certainly I think that we're kind of in a moment right now where there are some folks in America who are tired of hearing about Black history or tired of hearing about the issues that Black folks and other marginalized groups have faced in our country in the past. And so I think probably what we're seeing now is people sort of wanting to, put their fingers in their ears and say, "I can't hear you, I can't hear you." So I think that's kind of what's driving a lot of this backlash to all of our history being taught. I don't know whether my book will be banned or face any kind of legal issue like that. I do know that Oklahoma was one of the first states to pass a law that is, these laws that have kind of been bundled under the agenda against quote unquote critical race theory. Oklahoma passed one of the very first laws in that arena in May 2021. It was actually just a few weeks before the centennial of the race massacre, and it caused a big controversy here because, on one hand, the city of Tulsa and the state were sort of saying, "We really want to commemorate this horrible event, make sure it never happens again, make sure you remember." But on the other hand, they were saying, "We're going to pass this law that states that if a student feels uncomfortable in class, they might have recourse to punish the teacher or the school." And so we're definitely living in an era of, like, I think the city sort of talks out both sides of its mouth sometimes. Certainly the state of Oklahoma does. But to your point, I do think it's actually really healthy and important to discuss these issues of the past. There could be catharsis in it, I think, in terms of for Black people. I think just being able to reconnect with that legacy that we have, both in terms of activism, fighting for our rights in all kind of areas in the past in Greenwood, but also just realizing Greenwood was a real place with actual people who lived beautiful day-to-day lives. And I think for white people, there can also be something helpful about acknowledging the darker issues that occurred. I was able to interview one older white man who his grandfather was in the white mob in Tulsa. And so we had a discussion about that and sort of how he had learned about it and how it had impacted his experiences. And this was somebody who I think had, because he understood that aspect of his history more, it made him more predisposed to make sure that he and his family and his life would never recreate those kind of things. So he became, I think, a bigger advocate for racial justice from knowing and acknowledging the fact that his family had this really dark past. And so I think there's something really healthy about acknowledging these things and trying to have discussions that cross racial lines about them. But I also think that, not everyone agrees, and the people that don't agree seem to be gaining more and more political power by the day.
I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to Like It Is. My guest is Victor Lukerson, author, Built from the Fire, the epic story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street. Let's talk about popular culture. What has American culture or pop culture gotten wrong about Black Wall Street in its recent excavation of the massacre? From your research and perspective.
Sure. Well, I'd probably go back to the Watchmen depiction on the television show The Watchmen, which I really actually did enjoy as a creative work. I thought they did a really interesting job of censoring a Black story and a Black narrative on that show. But to go back to how the show starts, it's this sort of 7 to 8 minute depiction of the race massacre as it unfolds. And you see these men and white robes, Ku Klux Klan robes, shooting anonymous Black people, and it's very violent and graphic and has a feeling of spontaneity, I would say. And something I've sort of been trying to emphasize, help people understand, is that the Tulsa Race Massacre was not spontaneous. Originally, before being called a massacre, it's long been known as a riot. Tulsa Race Riot was the terminology used until just a few years ago, which I think implies a level of spontaneity, not being planned, sort of spur of the moment kind of situation. When in fact we know for a fact that, first of all, there were real estate men in the city of Tulsa who were eyeing the area where Greenwood was to make it to an industrial site. Greenwood is very, very close to downtown Tulsa. And so, if we think about the way gentrification works today, where you have a wealthy part of town, often near a black community, and the black community ends up getting sort of priced out or bought out. That was something that people were interested in doing in before 1921 in Tulsa, and sort of trying to figure out a way to do it. We also know that on the actual night of the race massacre, that Tulsa's police commissioner and others were deputizing citizens, white citizens, some of whose names they did not even know. They were handing these men badges without even knowing their names. One police officer said on that night to a person who was deputized, "Get a gun and get busy, try to get a nigger." Another police officer later said in testimony that he admitted that some of these folks who were deputized, quote, probably applied the torch. And so we sort of know that law enforcement was involved in sort of perpetuating this attack. And then even afterwards, we know that the real estate folks who had been sort of eyeing the neighborhood sort of launched several schemes to try to get convince people, black folks, to sell their property, to try to pass city council ordinances that make it harder for them to rebuild. We know that loans were not issued at affordable rates to black people. And so all of that stuff that sort of surrounds the actual event of the quote unquote mob is really important. And so I think that's something we haven't really sort of excavated yet, understanding all of these systems that were in play that go beyond a man with a gun standing on Greenwood Avenue. And so that's something I really try to highlight in the book, that this was all like a much larger system that involved people from the very highest halls of power in Tulsa, that ultimately tried and, managed to destroy Greenwood.
These were, as one title of a work is titled Ordinary People. They were upper class, middle class, and felt very much, I believe, in Greenwood instance, just as in some of the other massacres, very comfortable photographing, capturing the absolute atrocities that had occurred. Although I know you, I want you to talk about the fact that certain, I think the police commission, you said, prohibited pictures from being taken there in Tulsa. But I want to just mention, just for the audience, some very graphic pictures where you can see ordinary people just really milling around in some iconic, very horrible photographs. Marion, Indiana. James Cameron spoke about three black men, of which he was one, being lynched. About 30,000 people, good folks from Marion, Indiana. Indiana looking on with approval. One could look at the horrible lynching of Will Brown, where you see people mugging in front of his charred body. So people were very comfortable in terms of not being afraid of being photographed in these graphic incidents. Talk about the role of the newspaper, how, in some instances, I think the newspaper helped to fan the flames of the white insurrectionists, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's definitely true, Dr. Franklin. And again, there's sort of like the moment of the massacre and also all the context before that. And so in Tulsa, there were two white newspapers in the early 1900s, the Tulsa World and the Tulsa Tribune. And they sort of had different approaches to how they covered the black community. Tulsa World was largely indifferent. They very rarely even wrote about Greenwood. It was sort of invisible to them on a day-to-day basis. Tulsa Tribune, though, was much more sensational. And they became a little bit obsessed, I think, with this sort of imagined horror of black men and white women fraternizing. And so there would be these articles about police investigations into sort of what was going on with black men and white women sort of listening to ragtime together at these nightclubs in Tulsa. And there was even a column published at one point sort of warning black men that if you don't want to get lynched, don't be around white women. But this is all sort of like percolating, I would guess you would say, in the white press before the race massacre, and sort of feeding into the white reader's mind that black men are dangerous, that black people are criminals, and that their neighborhood has no value. So then, on the actual events leading up to the massacre, your readers may or may not know the sort of spark of the event, but there's a shoeshine boy named Dick Rowland. Who worked in downtown Tulsa, in White Tulsa. He needed to go to the restroom, so he entered an office building in downtown Tulsa. And the bathroom is on the fourth floor of this building, so we need to go in the elevator. At the time, all elevators had attendants, and the attendant was a young white teenager named Sarah Page. When Dick Rowland and Sarah Page were in the elevator together, the elevator lurches. Dick Rowland stumbles, grabs her arm, maybe steps on her foot. We don't know the exact details, but he touches Sarah Page, and then Sarah Page screams. Somebody else in the office building hears her scream, and then sees Dick Rowland sort of run away from the elevator because he obviously knows that now that she screamed, he's going to be in trouble, basically. Dick Rowland gets arrested. And the way the press comes into this is that, no one would have really known any of this happened except for the police, Dick Rowland, and Sarah Page. But the Tulsa Tribune published an article that was headlined, "Nab Negro for Attacking Girl in Elevator." And the Tulsa Tribune cast this incident as an attempted rape. They said that Dick Rowland scratched her face, tore her clothes, things that weren't true. The account was later totally discredited by the police. And Sarah Page actually ended up dropping any charges against Dick Rowland. So none of this was true, but this article goes out into the community on May 31st. And that is really what sort of gins people up. On the white side of town, they think this guy's tried to rape a white woman. And so they all start gathering around the courthouse to sort of really to form a lynch mob. And on the black side of town, when they read this article, they know that Dick Rowland's in danger. So they begin arming themselves on the black side of town, planning to go protect him. So this article that was published by the Tulsa Tribune, which was sort of feeding into their already sort of frenzy about black and white fraternizing, was really sort of the kindle for the fire of what would ultimately happen leading up to the race massacre.
We conclude part one of our discussion with Victor Lukesson, author, Built from the Fire, the epic story of Tulsa's Greenwood District, America's Black Wall Street. Join me for part two on our next show. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.